the success of the afternoon will in part be when we get to the panel discussion and the open forum, how much interaction there is with people in the room. So I would encourage you, if you've not already done so, to be thinking about what things you'd like to say, to contribute, what questions you'd like to ask. So that I think is an important part to look forward to. We will finish at 5, and the panel discussion, the question and answer, I'll try to merge in. When we get to the panel discussion, I will be joined up here by Mark, who we've already heard, and also by Professor Eleanor Kulinskaya, who will be speaking to us next. Eleanor holds the Aviva Chair of Statistics at the University of East Anglia. She's Director of Machine Learning and the Statistics Laboratory of School and Computing Science there. They've been involved with Aviva for over a period of 20 years, collaborating, I think, mainly on the use of computing science data and health issues. Eleanor's research has been to develop statistical evidence and meta-analysis using recent, more recent big data analysis techniques, looking at their applications in insurance, in health, environmental science. She's currently supervising 5 PhD students on topics ranging from the survival and longitudinal analysis of primary care data through to applications looking at longevity and pensions. So coming at it very differently from the general insurance world that we've maybe focused on so far. She's co-authored many, many research papers and undertakes a lot of joint research projects, including with the Economic and Social Research Council, funded through various government sources. So, Eleanor, very, very warm welcome to you to talk about the project that you're undertaking with the Institute and Faculty of Actuaries, looking at the use of big health, big data, big health and actuarial data for understanding its implications on longevity and morbidity risk. So, Eleanor, the floor is yours.
Thank you very much for inviting me here and for your warm introduction. So this is a joint talk with an actuary from Aviva, Nigel Wright, who is in Aviva Life Analytics team. And this is what I'm going to talk about. I'm not sure what it was, distress or amusement. Today we talked about many issues for big data, but the word statistics was not yet pronounced. So this is what I want to correct here, and I will be talking about big data and statistics. I'll mention a little bit big data research at UEA, and I will be talking a lot about recently granted pretty big grant on modeling longevity by the Institute, which is using big health and actuarial data to look at various trends in longevity, and I will give you a case study about the use of statins, which is sort of one of the very few drugs which do increase life expectancy. And I'll end up with some discussion. Right. We all talked about data explosion here today, and those are just two quotes I almost randomly got from internet, I suppose. The first one from Australian Public Service Big Data Strategy that says that 90% of data in the world today has been created in the last 2 years alone. And the second one is by Eric Schmidt, Google CEO in 2010, who said, "We now create as much information in 2 days as humans did from the beginning of history to 2003. So yes, it is big, no doubt about it. There is a lot of recognition about how much use potentially we can get out of the big data in various areas. And because of that, lots of different countries have developed their research strategies, investment, and so on about what to do with big data. You see here that Research Councils UK and America Office of Science and Technology started back in 2012. Australia, Canada, and Europe, 2013, Commonwealth countries, and India published their strategy in 2014. And yes, they did all mention the word big data, even though we were told that it sort of disappeared. I don't think it did really disappear. It's still there. Well, I was told by Louise Price that actually it's actuaries who invented the big data, because they were involved in the CMI from, I don't know, many centuries ago. So maybe this is the first known example of the big data. I personally met big data to do with genetics, genomics, proteomics, and that kind of applications quite a while ago. And of course, there is environmental sciences, climate data is pretty big, neuroscience, whereas brain scans are pretty big as well, and of course, business applications. And of course, there was a major involvement from the computing science, because you need to do something with big data. You need to safely store it, you need to process it, you need to quickly access it. And this is computing science issues. And of course, you need to analyze it. And that's why such areas as business analytics or data science are usually connected to big data. But in fact, statistical science, though it haven't played a real big role until recently, currently is being pretty much involved in the big data. And I would say that there is a really large need for involvement of statistical science. And so far, what we have seen, maybe it will be provocative, comparing to what we have heard before, but I think that quite a few things in analysis of big data so far were largely ad hoc. And maybe statisticians might help. And there is quite a bit of investment by SRC and by five big British universities who probably share the same view. There is Alan Turing Institute. UA was too small to go into that because the fee was $5 million, I think, to join. So UVA didn't join into that. But luckily, there is funding by other research councils. There is SRC funding, who has now a network on big data. There is NERC funding. They have their own network of big data, and so on. So things are moving on. So what are the statistical problems in the big data? First of all, lots and lots of false positives arising from multiple exploratory analyses. You repeat your analysis 1,000 times, you certainly will find some correlations there. Biases. Well, actuaries know quite a lot about various biases. For example, you look at health insurance, there is a lot of self-selection in health insurance clients. You look at now coming up secondary market in annuities, there will be a lot of self-selection there, and so on. Missing data is really a bane of big data and not clear what to do about it. Whereas linkage-related problems are data gathered at various levels of granularity, and we need to somehow put it all together. Causal inference from mostly correlational data. I'm sure you heard, for example, about the Google story when they tried to predict a flu epidemic from amount of searches for flu-related symptoms, or was it drugs, don't remember, but basically they got it twice more than it was in reality. Well, statisticians know that correlation doesn't mean causation. And another very interesting statistical problem in big data is, sorry, I need to stay here. A very important problem in big data is heterogeneity. There are lots and lots of different data, completely different kinds, and generated in very different ways, and to model that heterogeneity is what statisticians could do, and I think this is pretty important. I'll tell you about research which is going on at UEA, and it has to do with the SRC Business and Local Government Data Research Center. This is part of SRC Big Data Network, and this is funded for 5 years from 2014 for so-called Eastern Arch universities, which is Essex, UEA, and Kent, and we have a little bit involvement from London School of Economics. And this is pretty big center, 5 million. It has a lot of functions to do with collecting the data safely, keeping it, providing access to data for various researchers, facilitating various things to do with innovative practice-relevant research. It provides training, it has business engagement program, it has quite a wide steering committee on which there are quite a few companies, such as, for example, Experium or Aviva, as long as various local authorities, that kind of thing. But what I'm more interested is the research program, which is also associated with this big data center. And there are several research streams in the data. There is regional drivers of smart economic growth. There is support for vulnerable people, say elderly or children. There is mapping of green infrastructure. And then there is methodologic program of this I'm much more interested in. And finally, various kinds of data can be safely accommodated at the UK Data Archive, which is based at Essex. And we also can provide access to the data through different means, including safe rooms at Essex and now at UEA as well. So what we are hoping, for example, with our Big Data Institute grant is that if we do get CMI data and it needs to be kept securely, we can keep it in the UK Data Archive. Right. Methodology research stream in this big data center has two components. The first component is more or less to do with computing science. And here you can see pretty much things which you already partly heard about today. There will be various methodologies for merging data from multiple sources, data quality grading, cleaning, and so on. The third one is pretty interesting. This is privacy preserving issues. And of course, privacy is paramount in the big data. So what this research is trying to do is to a little bit change the data so that it won't be, each individual won't be recognizable in the data, but we don't want to distort it so much that it will lose relevance. So we want just to distort it, you know, enough so the privacy is preserved, but the substance is still there. And there are various other machine learning and other methods for various things which I don't want to dwell for too long. The second part of the research program is to do with more or less statistical issues. It's to do with modeling and predicting complex and adaptive socioeconomic systems. So here we are looking at various models for the analysis of local government, health and social care data. We look at evidence synthesis for data at various levels of aggregation. Early warning systems, for example, how to catch on time when something is going wrong, say with school students or with within a care home. And also we're developing new methods for methodology of observational data analysis, because of course the big data is first of all observational data, it's not a design data. Right, and now I'm going to talk for quite a long time about the most exciting thing which happened to me recently, which is this institute given a grant on use of big health and actuarial data for understanding longevity and morbidity risk. So this is funding from 2016 to 2020. First of all, you can see that our consortium consists of two schools at UA, School of Computing Sciences and Norwich Medical School. And we also have participation from Aviva. I'm the PI on the grant, but our team is really multidisciplinary. We have a computer scientist, Beatrice de la Iglesia. We've got Ruth Hancock is a health economist. Nick Steele is GP and, I suppose, health researcher. Both are from Norwich Medical School. And we also have an actuary and a senior data analyst from Aviva Life Risk Analytics team who would be providing their time pro bono. Okay, so the main objectives of our grant are as following. We are going to model mortality and trends in mortality, I should say. We would be also modeling trends in morbidity and in uptake of various new medical advances and interventions. We will be looking at assessing basis risk. We will be trying to evaluate longevity improvement. And for that one, we would be using both the health data and the CMI data, and for basis risk as well. And we are going to create software tools to forecast longevity risk of a book. But I am going to tell you about what we are going to do for each of those objectives in what follows. So, this is, by the way, was publicity. This is an article from Telegraph. Yes, sorry about this. I had really bad time for the first couple of weeks after there was press release. But anyway, I'm very happy that it's finished by now. So what is the data on this grant? We are going to use the data from the so-called the Health Improvement Network, which is acronym is THIN. So those are GP records. We are going to get all patients born before 1960 and followed to January 2015. So basically everyone who was over 55 at the 1st of January 2015. And that is 3.4 million patients. And of course, many of them were coming to their GPs pretty often. So it's a biggish data. We are going to add various social economic status variables such as index of multiple deprivation or mosaic, and we also are going to use CMI data, as I said. So two sources, health and actuarial data there. So our first objective is to do with identification and quantification of the key factors affecting mortality and longevity. Here, we are going to choose 3-5 conditions and work with them, or interventions. One of the things we want to look at is exactly statin prescriptions, because as I mentioned, statins do help to live longer, and you will hear the case study on statins later in this talk. But we are going to have other conditions, for example, MI or diabetes or heart failure. Unfortunately, we thought and we discovered that we cannot have cancer, basically because of limitations of the data, because cancer is not well recorded in primary care data or in secondary care data. To that matter, cancer, we would need to get data from cancer registers, which we don't yet have, maybe for the next grant. So we are mostly going to concentrate on heart and maybe diabetes and that kind of disease, for which we do have good recording in the general practice data. Interventions may include introduction of some new NICE guidelines. For example, NICE recently expanded the use of statins to people at lower risk of cardiac events. How would that impact life expectancy? Or, for instance, with blood pressure, current NICE guidelines is to keep upper systolic blood pressure at 140. What would happen if they would lower this threshold to 120? How would that affect life expectancy? So that kind of questions we are going to look at. And lifestyle factors may include obesity or smoking or alcohol. Once more, one of the data limitations is that we don't have data on diet and we don't have data on physical activity. Okay, so for each of these conditions, we are going to design a population-based prospective cohort study. So basically, one part of statistical approach to big data is don't use all the data. We don't need to use all the data, partly because a large part of the data is rubbish and it may be biased. What we want to do, exactly because the data is big, we can afford to extract a well-balanced design subset of the data and do our analysis on that extract. So here we are going to implement a case control design. For example, people who had heart attack will be cases, and they will be matched with 3-5 controls who would be people from the same GP practice, of the same gender and the same age. So that would allow us to have the data set where would be, say, 1 to 3 case to controls, which would resolve the issue of rare diseases, for example, where you have only, say, 5% of cases and you can't see anything. And it won't lose much efficiency, so we still would see what we want to see. After that, after we know which condition we are going to work with, we would look at various medical literature, systematic reviews, meta-analysis, because we want to come up with a list of relevant things we want to put in the model, what we want to adjust for. And of course, we're also going to use medical expertise within the team. That's why we have Mick Steele in our team. He will tell us what is important, what is not, when things change, and so on. And after that, we are going to arrive at a final model through backward elimination. What is important? We're also going to have multi-level model, not really multi-level, but it will be two-level model. The first level will be patient, and the second level will be GP practice, because it's pretty important to recognize the clustering of patients within practices. As we discovered, GP practice might change your hazard ratio from 1/2 to 2, say, 4 times easily, depending on who is your GP. Right, now we're coming to the second A, which is modeling of temporal changes in the factors affecting morbidity and mortality. And here we are going to look at the trends in incidence, prevalence of particular conditions. And we also will look in detail why is it happening? What are the patterns? Who gets intervention first? How soon will the other people catch up? And so on. For example, patients in the more deprived area may not get the most expensive intervention for a while. And that would serve to increase a differential between the more affluent and the less affluent areas. So if we want to understand how would a particular interaction affect the life expectancy of a population, we really need to know how that intervention is being taken up by various strata of the society. This is just an example from research by my PhD student, Lizanne Gitzels, on patients who have had heart attack. So here we've got four cohorts, people who have had heart attack before age 60, before age 65, before age 70, and before age 75. And those covered lines there are various drugs and other interventions. Statin is there in black. Unfortunately, I don't have a pointer. But if you look, say, at age 70 and age 75, you will see that the black line starts from pretty low level back in 95, and it goes practically to 100%. So these days, everyone who has had a heart attack, say by age 70, will be on statins. And they also will be on aspirin. That is the orange line, which sort of gets to the same level of 100%. But there are other interventions which are not that popular yet. For example, look at the beta blocker, which is a blue line, and you will see that actually beta blocker, which actually does increase life expectancy for people after heart attack by about a year, uptake is only about 60%. And what is even more pronounced here is the most expensive intervention here. It's called coronary revascularization. Basically, it's heart surgery. It can be bypass, it can be angioplasty, and you will see that there it is not going up as fast as statins, and it stays at about 40%. So who would get heart surgery? This picture here shows you three important factors. There may be more. First of all, you see that age is pretty important. Earlier ages have less heart surgery than later ages. The second very striking factor here is gender. Men often have twice as more heart surgery as females. Why, I don't know, but it may well be some sort of gender discrimination given going on here. Maybe surgeons perceive that females don't need it. I don't know. And finally, you can see very linear effect of socioeconomic status from the affluent to deprived. It's practically linear effect. So that's why we want to model this uptake of interventions, because as you can imagine, it will greatly affect life expectancy of a particular disease or intervention. Right. Our third aim is more or less how to translate our conclusions from the general population, which is seen data, to a population of interest to your particular insurance company, which is a very specific population and different from the general population. And for that, we need three components. First of all, we need this model for survival differentials for a particular disease, which we have done in the AIM-1. We need the model for incidence prevalence or uptake of intervention over time. And we also need sufficient knowledge of the population of interest to which is desired to translate our results. Or basically, we need to assess the basis risk. And for that, we are hoping to use the CMI data. Our fourth aim is development of software tools to enable you to play, basically, with various scenarios. So there will be an R package which would provide analytical and graphical means to forecast longevity, and you would also be able to put in user-defined composition of your book, for example, and see what happens when, I don't know what, heart attack incidents will drop 10%. It will be open source software available from the website, and we also will have a manual. We also intend to develop teaching materials, which also will be on the website. And probably we will be running CPD courses on the use of it as well. But this is pretty far away, so let's not worry about it yet. And now I'm coming to the case study, which is basically a big chunk of a PhD by my PhD student, Lizanne Gitzels. And as you see, the supervisors are the same people, Nick Steele as a medical supervisor and Nigel Wright as an actuary. So this is a little bit of an explanation. Basically, we are looking at CVD, cardiovascular disease, which are diseases of heart and circulation. And cholesterol would clot the arteries common to the heart, and therefore it will increase the risk of various nasty events such as heart attacks and strokes, and statins or other lipid-lowering therapy is prescribed to help with it. This is what you will get if you come into your GP for so-called health MRT. They would click on their computer, asking sometimes you various questions, but you can do it yourself online. This is so-called Q-risk calculator. So as you see, there are some age, sex, ethnicity, lifestyle factors such as smoking, some diseases there, diabetes, atrial fibrillation, blood pressure, this and that. And after you fill on that, or sometimes you can leave things blank if you don't know it, you will get your risk estimate for the first cardiac event in the next 10 years. And the current NICE guidelines, until recently, was that you should be prescribed statins if your risk is above 20%. And a couple of years ago, they changed the guidance and they lowered the risk to 10%. And there was awful lot of outcry from GPs and various other people because really it's 4.5 UK residents who are now eligible for statins. And GPs felt that this is medicalizing completely healthy population because those people didn't have any events yet. There is just 10% risk that they might get an event in the next 10 years. There was meta-analysis of a number of clinical trials, which was the reason why NICE decided on that guidelines. And this evidence is not very good as far as life expectancy is concerned. If you look at those things, in meta-analysis, they are called forest plot. So each line there is confidence interval for log hazard ratio of 1 millimole reduction in cholesterol at different levels of risk. And as you see, majority of those confidence intervals actually intersect zero. So they are not significant. I think only one, which is for 5 to 10% risk. That seems to be significant, just 0.99 is the upper limit of the confidence interval. But the rest of them are not. But when you put it all together, regardless of the level of risk, you have this diamond, which is the result in combined confidence interval. And that one shows that there is some benefit to life expectancy from using statins. Not clear for which group it really is good. Why we don't like clinical trials. And this doesn't only apply to this particular meta-analysis. I have looked at lots and lots of meta-analyses for various conditions. And basically, medical meta-analyses are not quite good for insurance purposes. And that happens because mostly they are based on clinical trials. And so you have particular selection of patients, people with comorbidities on multiple drugs, for example, or elderly are excluded. They won't have long follow-up because clinical trial gets money for 3 years or 5 years, but not for 20 years. They won't be adjusted for any confounders, for any other variables, because usually medical people, when they design clinical trial, they really believe in randomization. They just believe that all patients and on controls, on average, would be about the same, which may or may not be true. So what we really want to see is what is survival benefit of starting for healthy people, for different risk groups of Q risk at various ages in the general population. So we decided on four age cohorts, 60, 65, 70, and 75. We are using here all medical records of people born between 1920 and 1940 and observed from 87 to 2011. And we excluded everyone who already had some cardiovascular disease. So this is healthy people we are looking at. We have quite a few missing data here, mostly in BMI, smoking status, risk of cardiac event, Q risk, because we couldn't fill that form for them. So we had pretty complicated way of doing multiple imputation. It was the best available, and that one is available free from the University of Bristol website. We have used Cox proportional hazards model. The model is written, I don't know what happened when that came from my computer to here. You can't see the model. Okay. Basically, our hazard for a patient I at general practice J has some baseline hazard, lambda naught, and it has a factor which is based on general practice, which is denoted here by ZJ, and it also has a regression in the on the log hazard scale. So all our predictors would define regression on the log hazard scale there. And one of the covariates in that model would be risk group, low, moderate, or high. And we have done four different models at four different ages. This is how many people we have had and how long we could observe them. As you see, the maximum follow-up was quite long, from 24 years sometimes to 16 years. And it wasn't really big data, but as I said, it was biggish data. Those are survival plots. You can see that our median life expectancy, a little bit less than 90, for example, this blue line would be age 75, and the median survival for them is a little bit less than 15 years. So 75 plus 15 is 90, a little bit less. This one is very interesting. This is distribution of risk across ages and genders. And what follows from this one is that men are at much higher risk of cardiac events than women. If you look at age 60, 83% of women are in the low risk group, and only 16% of men are in the same low risk group. When you move to age 65, just no men whatsoever in the low risk group. And Finally, when we moved to age 70, no women in the low risk group either, but at least 80% of women are at moderate risk and 83% of men are at high risk. And finally, at 75, all men are at high risk group. This is our aim too, partly. This is how statin prescription changed over time from 87 to 2011. You can see that it slowly went up, but still it only reaches what, a bit under 50% at best in a particular age group. So it's very far from all people who are in high risk group are getting statins now. And for low and moderate risk group, the lower plot there, you can see that prescriptions are really under 25%. Now, looking at this plot once more, what you can see from here also is perhaps age discrimination. Because the younger people at age 60, 65 are getting considerably more statin prescriptions than patients at age, say, 75. Which is also interesting. And this is finally the results about how statins increase or otherwise life expectancy. Those are hazard ratios, and I would like you to look at the half, right half of the plot, because the left half is unadjusted results, which are not of real interest. So let's look at the right plot. You can see that the results are stratified by risk groups, and within risk groups, they are stratified by age. So the first part is low risk, less than 10%, and there we have only youngest age groups, 60 and 65. And you can see that there is absolutely no sense in taking statins, because those lines are confidence intervals once more. So when we look at moderate risk, 10 to 19%, you can see that it very much depends on age. No benefit at age 60 or age 65, but yes, benefit for 70 or 75. And finally, of course, when we move to the high risk, still at age 60, no benefit. But there is really quite a big benefit for older ages, from 65 onwards. So you can see that what we discovered from this research is that the guidelines for the use of statins should actually be age-dependent and, of course, risk-dependent. So there doesn't seem to be much benefit of prescribing statins at lower, well, moderate risk group for younger ages, say 60 or 65, but there is some benefit in prescribing statins for age 70 or above. So those are the conclusions. There are some implications for medical and public health research, age discrimination, which we probably noticed, the need for age and risk-dependent guidelines. Of course, there are lots of benefits for a person, for public user, if you want. You would be able to calculate your average life expectancy and confidence limits. You can decide how you're going to structure retirement funds depending on this life expectancy. You can see what lifestyle changes you can make, and you probably should be on statins by age 70. And finally, of course, there are lots of implications for insurance and for government as well, health service, for example. And those would be pricing and reserving for longevity risk, morbidity and mortality risk, predicting volumes of coverage of various medical procedures, and predicting changes in population life expectancy. And that's all I was going to say. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Eleanor. That was fascinating. Do you want to come and join us up here? That would be lovely. What we're going to do now is we're just going to give the working party a chance to let you know what work they're undertaking. And it seems to me what we've covered so far today, we've had an introduction into... Yes, of course. we've had an introduction into the whole data science universe. We've looked at various aspects of cognitive computing and how some of the tools and techniques may develop with IBM. And we've just had a really interesting example of the big data and how to analyze big data and get something fascinating out of it. In the conversation that will follow the next bit, I think it's really, as far as possible, it's questions like, what issues are going through people's minds? What issues arise for our profession? Are we doing enough? How relevant is what we've heard to our profession? Questions like that. But also, I think we'd be very grateful for any steer for the working group. So that's why the next section, really, on what the working group is doing, so you can, in the conversation afterwards, maybe give us some direction, be really helpful, as well as the bigger subjects. So we're going to ask first Alicia, and then Ben, and then I think it's Matt, and then Alex, who each lead one of the work streams, to come up just to introduce themselves, talk a little bit about the work stream, and pass the baton on. Hopefully that way it'll give you a bit of colour to what the working party within the Institute and Faculty of Actuaries is doing. After that, we'll then have the panel and open conversation. So maybe, Alicia, you start with yourself, if that's all right.